You're going to start a discussion of how we're living in the golden age by talking about a comic that ended in 1990 or 1991?
Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the golden age.
Hello, I'm Adam.
And I'm Joe. We're here to talk about why exactly it is we've called our podcast The Golden Age and what it is that we're thinking of when we're talking about a golden age. And Adam, I think, you know, I really like, I should hope so because we wrote it together, but I really like our intro talking about a plethora of delights and just how much of an abundance of entertainment that we have today. And the more I think about entertainment and the more I think about how my leisure time, I keep increasingly coming back to a comic from Calvin and Hobbes, one of the Sunday panels, I believe. This one was from August 28, 1988. And no, my memory's not that good. I just happen to have the website up and conveniently gives the date. But Calvin and Hobbes are, as they frequently do, plummeting down a hill in Calvin's red wagon. Talking about how the summer went by really quickly. And Hobbes says, "There's never enough time to do all the nothing you want." And that, to me, just encapsulates the dilemma of the Golden Age. We are surrounded by great entertainment, so much entertainment in so many different mediums, that it's hard at times to pick what to do, because there's so much you want to do, and every time you pick something, you're implicitly leaving out a bunch of other things that you might enjoy doing at that given time.
Absolutely. If you had asked me, or if you had told me when I was a kid that there would be so many superhero-related shows on television, for example, that I would just have to pick and choose between them according to my level of interest and what actors were involved and what the take was. Just as with any normal show, I probably would have laughed in your face. In fact, I remember back in 1990, clipping out a newspaper article that said that there would be a Spider-Man movie out in 1994. And that's a heck of a long time for a kid to wait for a movie about his favorite superhero. And that's just one example, but in every medium, in every type of content you want to name, I would suggest there's more of that being generated and marketed in the 21st century than pretty much there ever has been, including poetry.
Yeah, I would have to agree. It's just amazing how many choices are out there. And even if you limit yourself to just one area, as you say, TV shows, even if you limit yourself to TV shows that are high quality, well-written, and entertaining, there's still more TV shows than we would ever have time to watch. And it's not just TV shows. It's every time I sit down, I have to decide, am I going to watch a TV show? Am I going to play a game? Am I going to read a book? Am I going to check out comic books? And then within each of those categories, there's just such a wealth of options to pick from.
And if by some stretch of the imagination, what is being produced today is not your speed, and I think that if you have trouble finding stuff being produced today that is not your speed, that problem probably lies with you, because there are all sorts of performers and entertainers who enjoy doing pastiches of, you know, past styles of music and games and stories. If nothing you hear or see today is to your liking, then, of course, older forms of entertainment are more readily available for your consumption than ever before. It used to be that you were going to have to do a lot of searching if you wanted to listen to an old record that only you remembered, or some particularly rare issue of the Fantastic Four you wanted to read to find out what exactly happened. And nowadays, thanks to the internet's online marketing platforms and so much else. All that stuff is at your fingertips.
Yeah, it really is incredible. You know, I remember growing up, as I'm sure you do, a store that my kids have had absolutely no experience of and haven't ever really seen, Blockbuster Entertainment, where you would go to rent videos. And the outside walls of the store, or rather the perimeter of the store, was lined with all of the new releases, the movies that had come out in the past year or so on video. And then the main shelves in the store was the back catalog, such as it was, to rent and to watch. And I don't know, there'd be maybe 50 or so movies in each genre that they carried, whatever happened to be most popular. But if you wanted something that was less popular, that didn't move as well, you couldn't watch it, basically. There was no way to get a hold of it, unless by some miracle the library system had a copy to check out and you could get it shipped over from a library somewhere far away. But absent that, you were limited to the movies that were there or whatever episodes of TV shows they happened to have on video to rent. And that was your choice of Friday night entertainment. And I remember it being kind of a big thing growing up, going with my dad or going with my mom down to Blockbuster and spending inevitably about 45 minutes or so walking through the shelves and trying to find a movie that everyone in the family could agree on out of the limited selection that they had. And that was growing up. And now we've got on demand with anything you might care to rent from the iTunes movie store, from Amazon, or from other sources, just a huge variety of movies to pick from when you sit down to watch something.
You know, you're mentioning that I was about to make the fairly obvious point that, of course, if the store didn't have it, then it might not even be their fault. Maybe it just wasn't distributed because companies only released a much more limited line of products. But you raise a question for me there already. I was just thinking about collecting and how you had to go searching for that record or that particular movie, and thinking about collectors in general and how, you know, it's no longer, there's this certain aspect of being a collector, at least when it comes to entertainment, that is gone, that it is no longer necessary to have a full run of a comic book or what have you in order to have experienced it all.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from. As a teenager, I bought music CDs that I enjoyed listening to, and I curated my choices fairly carefully. And the music that I had purchased or could afford to purchase pretty much made up what I listened to, and I knew albums and songs really, really well. I was very, very good at hearing the first half second of a song and being able to tell you which song it was, which band did it, and which album of theirs it was from, because I had a collection that was not tiny, but relatively small, and I listened to it constantly, so I knew it fairly well. And today, with a Spotify subscription, I've got access to thousands and thousands of albums, and I can listen to anything that catches my fancy in any way. But I've lost some aspect of that, of collecting music, to where you have a collection that you get to know really, really well.
Yeah, my mind has been similarly affected. The less you need that recall function, the less you use it and the less it's available to you. Much like Aristotle, I think it was, who warned that books were going to... This is obviously apocryphal, but he said that books were going to be the end of people's memories.
Well, clearly that is the case. There's far less information that I could remember than I would be able to if it wasn't written down somewhere.
Yeah, so are there any more drawbacks? I know we want to discuss in particular what we find so fantastic about this golden age of entertainment, particular selections and what we find fantastic about each particular sector. But just real quick, let's be intellectual about this for just a moment more. Obviously, I think, or at least I think as far as entertainment goes, a large part of this is just technology and what's available now, but I would think that another part of it is how youth culture had steadily grew throughout the 20th century, and it became, I think, as we grew up, an acceptable thing for adults to have any kind of fun they wanted. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I would. I don't know that I want to oversell that point, because it's very popular and trendy to say that society today is made up of a bunch of overgrown kids who don't know how to handle the real world. And I don't know that I want to drag entertainment into that per se. But I think there is a certain element of, call it increased leisure time, call it increased money to spend on entertainment, but there's a certain element of you don't have to give up some of your pleasures as you grow older. We have the ability to bring them along with us. And I think partly it's just production. There's so much more there's so much more entertainment produced today than there used to be, that there now actually is a whole section of entertainment that is aimed at people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, that is designed to appeal to them in a way that perhaps wasn't available in the 1950s or the 1940s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's exactly right. And what better example, perhaps, than board games, which used to be, you know, Monopoly and these sorts of things. At least I know that they were marketed toward children, except for war games, back when I was little. But now we're experiencing this amazing resurgence. Some people call it the board game renaissance. But it was, and I've checked on this, but it was about the year 2000 when board game sales, which had always kind of steadily grown over time, just took off. And now it's a really hot thing to do. You know, you have board game cafes, you have groups of friends coming over to play the new game that someone bought. It's a great bit of fun.
Yeah, it definitely is. And that actually reminds me of something that I'd been thinking as well, that part of the explosion in entertainment that makes this a golden age is the rise of international trade over the past 30 or so years. It's just so much easier to get stuff from other countries than it used to be. Information travels so much better than it used to. That part of what happened in the U.S. was there was this gaming culture that had existed in Europe, and all of a sudden it hopped the Atlantic, and all of the conversations that were happening in Europe, all of the games that were in Europe, it was just very easy to transport that over to the U.S., whether physically or just in terms of information, and integrate U.S. gaming culture into the European gaming culture. And now you've got something that's so much bigger than it had been before. But yeah, gaming is just an incredible example of the sheer number of options that we have available to us and the increasing quality of options that are available.
And I'm sure there was always something of an adult board gaming culture in America. I don't know how big it was, but of course there were always parlor games, there were card games, there was Trivial Pursuit and what have you. But yeah, I don't feel like it was always on this level. So you're saying that that was entirely a European thing? I've realized that a lot of these new classics, like Carcassonne, came over from Europe.
Yeah, that's been my understanding, is it's been a European thing. There is a rather prestigious set of awards that are given out each year in Germany, the Spiel des Jahres. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. The Spiel des Jahres that's given out to the best game of the year, and they pick the actual game of the year and then the runners-up, and they actually have three different versions of the Spiel des Jahres award. They've got the Kennerspiel des Jahres, which is your connoisseur, really serious games, and then they've got the Kinderspiel des Jahres, which is awards for the best children's games, and then the regular Spiel des Jahres is just games that I guess you would say normal adults enjoy playing. But you look at the games that I'm sure we both know of that are popular among our friends, Settlers of Catan, Carcassonne, Ticket to Ride, Dominion, these are all games that have won the Spiel des Jahres Award. This is all something that, like I say, has come out of Europe, really, that community, and then hopped the Atlantic and become big in the U.S. But I know every time Christine and I go to a gaming store and we're asking about new games, part of what they're pitching is, well, this is what was really talked about at the Spiel des Jahres this year, or this was the Spiel des Jahres winner. Inevitably, these are really, really good, entertaining games.
Well, that's cool. A number of these games, I'm a latecomer to, and perhaps just because everyone else was already too good at them to play with, I never got particularly interested. Ticket to Ride is an exception. I've played Ticket to Ride plenty of times, but let's say Codenames has recently swept like fire through my circles of friends. That's a really good one.
The 2016 award winner.
Oh, no kidding. Well, there you go. Cards Against Humanity before that, although I'll bet that didn't win an award.
No, and that one seems to have been a U.S. creation rather than a European creation.
How could it be anything else?
Exactly.
I love it. It used to be that adults just came around and talked and drank, and now we come around and play board games and drink.
Right. There's no reason the drinking and the talking has to stop. It just gives you something a little more entertaining to do, perhaps, than sitting around a couch.
And there's also this new wave of games that are really cool. Have you played Quiplash?
The name sounds familiar, but no, I haven't played it.
It's fantastic. So you use an app. I think it's an app on your smartphone. You all download it. And you use a computer, an actual computer, as the game screen. And everyone uses their smartphones as their own personal input devices. And so the game gives categories such as something a dog would say to his master, or, you know, what something that gives you potential for a funny quip, and then everyone puts theirs in, and then everyone votes on what the funniest line is.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's this fun merger, you know, of these kind of conventional gaming structures with technology.
Yeah, and making something that's more than the sum of its parts.
Exactly. I just played it for the first time last month, and just it was great fun. So, you know, they're still coming up with new ideas.
Yeah, it just never ends. And that's part of what astounds me about board gaming, is just the sheer number and variety of games that come in. And of course, you play them long enough and they start to fit into various buckets. You can kind of describe one game as fitting into a certain category of gameplay or a category of scoring. But still, everyone manages to be different enough from the others that it's entertaining in its own right. But it's just so many that are coming out. I have a gaming group that I play with a couple of times a month, and invariably we're playing a game that is new to me. Occasionally we're playing a game that we've played before, but I'm able to go to this group, and have been for a couple of months now, and constantly get to play something different and something interesting. And again, that's just not an option we had growing up. It was, you know, it was Monopoly or Mousetrap or Checkers. That was pretty much your choices.
Mm-hmm. Back in South Korea, in the expat community, there was kind of an unspoken rule. If you got to go home, you had to bring back a board game if you wanted to be accepted back into the community. You better bring us something new to play. Or at least that's how I felt about it. So I always would return as a mule with some new gimmick. Game of Thrones 1 year, boy, while we're talking, some games can be really, really complex. I don't think I played that game the same way twice.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the things I've liked about the gaming, is the rise of games that have actual complexity and strategy to them, rather than Monopoly, where you're just constantly rolling the dice and you've got a very, very simple set of actions that you take on any given turn. These games have so many choices and so many decisions to make that you're right. You can play them multiple times and play them completely different each time.
I was just talking about trying to figure out the rules.
Well, there you go. Yeah, that can be tough too.
But yeah, and if, you know, I mean, wargaming especially has been that complex for a very long time, although dear heaven, it took a certain kind of person to play one of those games before computers could do the number crunching for you. There's apparently some sort of World War II game that's considered the most complicated ever, and if you actually play a full game, which someone is attempting to do, then it will take you 20 years or something ridiculous like that.
I don't know if that's war gaming so much as that is war over simulation.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you can do this, you get you should get like an honorary degree from the wargaming college or something. Yeah, totally. Oh my God, how did I just forget the name? West Point. West Point is what I was thinking of. I have played one of these fabulously complex war games, by the way. One guy had miniatures and just these rules for these homemade rules, or not homemade, but there's this network of people who were creating war games and special miniatures for battles that most people had never heard of, like certain encounters in colonial Africa between the British and the Zulu and so forth. And I had the good fortune to be crushed by one such enthusiast in a in a playthrough. Although to be fair, he had the psychological advantage of me because we were naked.
Well, that's enough to put you off your game.
A little bit. My wife and I were trying to find places to just couch surf while we were in Southeast Asia. And so we looked at all these online forums and the rest. And one group said, "Hey, you can come stay with us, but we're nudists." And my wife and I said, "All right." Well, no, we were on our guard. We were a little bit nervous about that. But the hilarious thing is that, you know, when we got to the dorm, these blacked out windows, and both of us said to each other, you know, "Okay, if you feel uncomfortable about this, just run." We knocked on the glass pane door with this black curtain across it, and this door opened, and out popped the head of this glasses wearing English professor type with a big bushy beard, who said, you know, "Hello." And immediately we were just at ease. These people aren't dangerous, they're just weird.
Which is pretty much the definition of the English professor type.
Yeah. Oh, he spoke. He had this wonderful Edwardian accent, actually. I'm not doing him justice, but it was perfect. And so we went in, and I learned both this particular war game that I won't ever be able to play anywhere else, and also a Japanese version of chess, which was also really cool and very hard.
Yeah, and it strikes me, as I'm sure it has you from time to time, we're blessed with an abundance of games, but maybe going back to what we were talking about being collectors earlier, it's hard to become an expert at any one game when you've got such a huge variety to pick from. You know, there's the element of the person who plays chess, or the person who plays Go, or the person who plays any of these other traditional, deeply complex games where you can play it for 20 years and learn so much about the strategy of it, that maybe if we're talking about things we've lost in this golden age, it's hard to be that kind of an expert the way it used to be.
Yes, although some people manage, and this is why I stopped playing shooters online and the rest, like back in college, because I don't know, I just didn't have the time to invest, I guess, to be good enough to play on an even field with these people.
Well, I think that's part of it. You can either be a generalist who enjoys a little bit of everything, or you can be a deep specialist who obsessively plays one thing for 6 months or 2 years at a time. But I don't know that you can really be both.
Yeah, and that sort of thing is a young man's game. And if you're not a young man, I think you probably start out as one when you do it.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. And I think that segues nicely into the topic of console games, because that's something, computer gaming, console gaming is something I never used to do, but I've become interested in doing in the past 5 years. But there again, I face the same challenge of, I have, you know, maybe 2-3 hours a month to put into gaming, or that I choose to put into gaming. And I pay attention to the community of folks that are online, and there's people that put in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day on a given game, which is just hard to keep up with.
You have the advantage on me in console gaming. I have not played a console game with fervor since, Metal Gear Peace Walker, and even that was a handheld. I mean, just not since high school, essentially, maybe college.
Yeah, in console gaming, I admit I got into it because of the increase in graphics quality that we've had over the past 20 years. There's a ton of people online that have fond memories of their original Nintendo or their Super Nintendo or their Atari. And to be honest, I just had a hard time getting into those games as a kid, partly because the graphics were primitive back then. Part of the reason I love my PlayStation 4 so much is the graphical quality of the games on it. They just look absolutely gorgeous. They're works of art just in the visual department, leaving out gameplay entirely. And that's one of the things that attracts me to console games right now. And if I'm going to describe right now as a personal golden age of gaming, that would be part of the reason why. There's just so many games that look so good.
What does tempt me now and then to play an independent game and still gets me to buy the occasional Telltale game is the quality of storytelling, too. Now that console games and computer games are considered by many to be a legitimate art form, or at least form of entertainment that adults enjoy too. The same amount of work and the same budget is going into them. And even the same criticism now, I don't know if you've wandered into this section of the internet that, deconstructs video games and throws around terms like, ludonarrative dissonance, for example. And it's not that they don't have points. It's all pretty interesting.
Yeah, story is an element I hear a lot of people talking about, and the games I've played just haven't so far lent themselves to story so much, so it's not something that I'm as aware of, but I've certainly seen it. You know, there is an actual story, and in some games an actual plot that you're playing as a character, you're making decisions. There are things that are happening to you that have some degree of real meaning and significance, and you get to be involved with that, living it out in a fashion, which is certainly different from going through Mario levels and just collecting coins and rescuing a princess.
Yeah, it's very cool. I just bothered to look up the term ludonarrative dissonance because all of a sudden I couldn't even remember what it meant. It is the dissonance between a story's gameplay and a story's theme or story content. So, for example, if you're playing a game that criticizes the notion of individual interest above all else, then it's weird that in the game, you, the player, are continuously trying to level up and gain power. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. It's trying to make you think about something even as you're doing that very thing.
Yeah, which of course is a very common problem with, for example, war movies, which tend to take the tact that war is hell, a bad thing, and the last, and at the same time, almost inexorably glorify it.
Right, exactly. I think while we're on the subject of gaming, I'll also throw out, the Nintendo Switch, which has just been a huge seller over the past year. And we picked up one of those for Christmas. And again, it's technology as much as anything else that's making this a golden age. Because when I was growing up, you could have a Nintendo, Super Nintendo, that sat in your home connected to your TV and had a certain kind of games on it. And then you could have one of the Nintendo portables, and I'm not enough of a gamer to... Game Boy. You could have a Game Boy, which had vastly inferior graphics and a different type of games available, and you could kind of play one or the other, but it was a different experience. And now technology has advanced to the point where we've got this Switch that is at the same time both a portable and a stationary console. You can play games on your television with a certain level of quality, and then you can pick it up and take it out and about with you and play those exact same games with only a slightly reduced level of quality. And if you're into gaming, that is just such an incredible experience that just was not available to you, certainly 20 years ago, even 5 years ago.
Yeah, I remember just being gobsmacked when one of my students back in Korea showed me what he was playing on his iPhone, or not his iPhone, I'm sure he was playing with an Android. But anyway, I looked and he was playing Grand Theft Auto 3. In its full and unadulterated form, a game which, of course, was sold on the PlayStation. It used to take a console, and not a really ancient one, to play that.
Yeah, that's a game that would have been out on the PS3 when I was in college, which, you know, boy, was absolutely yesterday. We're not going to talk about that in terms of years. but you're right, we can put that same game on a smartphone today and play it with capacity to spare.
You can even, even the cutscenes and the like. One thing that I have done is just watch one of the compilations of a game's cutscenes on YouTube, and the result is watching a movie. You know, the graphics and the screenwriting and all of the rest are that high level enough quality.
Yeah. It really is a lot of people putting a lot of really serious work into games that's just impressive when you look at it.
So speaking of movies, dare we talk about the most conventional of entertainment forms here? Should we discuss movies? How do you feel about them in the 21st century?
Well, it's a subject we've, I think, beat to death over the last couple of weeks, that there's just such a huge variety of really high-quality comic book movies that we get to enjoy. If there's anything on the list that I'm going to question whether or not we live in a golden age, I think it is movies. I'm not convinced that the movies that are coming out today are necessarily all that much better than the movies that were coming out during any other decade, certainly in terms of picture quality and visual effects and CGI, we've never had it better. But movies is one medium where I think that kind of stuff is less important than it maybe is elsewhere. And the fact that movies look better today, I think a movie still stands and falls on its story.
I don't know if it's... I mean, yes, I think there is a dearth of creativity if you just look at the tent poles, because with so much on the line, Hollywood executives are more afraid of risk than ever. But at the same time, there's more stuff out there for you, and certainly new things being attempted, new barriers being broken.
Yeah, and that was an area where I was going to defer to you, because I only get out to two or three movies a year, what with, again, it's choices, but what with my general schedule and time availability, that's really all I make time for. And so my perception of the movies that are out there is mainly limited to the tent poles or the movies that get a ton of press. It's not often that I see a smaller movie. And so I think you have more exposure to that than I do. And so I'm certainly open to the idea that there's a lot of really good stuff out there that I'm just not either not aware of or not making the time to see.
Oh, yeah, I think there most definitely is. And, you know, I know you watch some television at home. So even on Netflix or Amazon or what have you, if you had turned your attention to movies, I think you would have found a ton of interesting material. And
I do see that there are movies out there that I read the description and go, huh, I wouldn't mind watching that. In fact, last night I was flipping through Amazon Prime selection and saw 310 to Yuma with Russell Crowe and Christian Bale, which I watched the first 10 or 15 minutes of, and it visually looked very good. I think the problem is, having become a parent, by the time you get the kids in bed and you have the ability to sit down and watch an adult movie, we're generally looking at somewhere around 8 or 8:30 in the evening. And if you're going to watch a typical 2-hour movie, that might have you staying up a lot later than you actually want to stay up on a given weeknight. And so I think part of my problem with watching movies is just finding a 2-hour, 2.5-hour chunk of time that's free.
Oh, okay, I can understand that. Thus the attraction of an episode of television instead.
Yeah, something that you can do in 45 minutes is honestly, at this point in life, a lot more attractive than something that takes 120 minutes. It's one of those things that I'm looking forward to changing as our girls get older, as they actually have the attention span and the ability to follow an adult movie. But boy, you try watching an adult movie with a 4-year-old and you've got her attention for about 7 minutes at most. And then she realizes she's bored because it's just people standing around and talking. And then she starts asking questions about what's going on. And then you hear none of the movie because you're dealing with a constant stream of questions.
See, it's funny. My mind actually works differently, though. And obviously, you're dealing with children here. But one thing that keeps me often from trying a television show is the amount of investment involved in time. You know, if I watch a movie, I know that that movie will end in 2 or 3 hours. And if I didn't really like it very much, oh well. But trying a new television series, especially if it's got more than one season under its belt, that's a 13-hour commitment.
Yeah, it's a 13-hour commitment, but it's a 13-hour commitment that you can do in 45-minute bite-sized chunks, and so it doesn't feel like that much of a commitment from my perspective, and I think just in terms of, hey, I want to spend time with my wife in the evenings, we want to have something that we can pick for entertainment without a lot of thought going into it, and so if we've got a TV show that we've been watching together, it's, you know, you're tired at the end of the day. It's an easy decision. All right, we're up to episode 7. Let's do it.
Well, I think you're right that movies sort of just exist on a continuum with the rest of with how they've been developing throughout the 20th century. But has anything been so revolutionized as television within the last 20 years or so?
Boy, I tell you, television is just amazing. I was looking at an article earlier today from, I believe, the New York Times in January. There was, if I'm remembering the number correctly, 487 scripted TV shows in 2017 alone, which is just an incredible number.
Good Lord.
And I mean, in all honesty, probably half or two-thirds of those TV shows are dreck that aren't really worth watching. But even if we say that that's the case, that's still leaving, you know, well over 100 TV shows that are worth watching.
Yeah, they say, you know, 99% of anything is caca, although I would actually disagree. I think that the percentage is much lower than that. Usually, if I watch a show, I can at least tell what smart people are trying to do, even if it doesn't quite come off.
Right, you can understand what someone's vision was, even if their execution was a bit lacking. Yeah, I think I would agree. It's not quite 99% of everything. It definitely is some lower percentage. I just pulled this article up, and the numbers it had in it were really astounding. 487 original programs aired last year. 15 years ago, there were just 182 original programs that were airing in a given year. So we've more than doubled the amount of entertainment that's available in a 15-year period, which is just, even if 95% of it is junk, sheer number of non-junk shows is higher than it's ever been.
That mirrors the book market, and so much else. One of the results of this golden age, the result of having so much more entertainment out there and something for everybody is that you've got this fractured market, or rather this fractured market means you have something for everybody, all of these different distribution channels. I was surprised to find, not John Candy, but, because he's dead, but John, who's the big guy? Come on, Joe.
John Goodman?
Yes, thank you. John Goodman on a political show a while back, just on Amazon. I was like, oh, there's John Goodman. It had not occurred to me that John Goodman had not been seen for a little while, but there he was on a channel that I wasn't watching, because you can't watch every channel anymore and keep up with what's going on.
See, I'm going to demonstrate my political nerddom cred here by saying that was, I'm betting, Alpha House, that was a pilot on Amazon a couple years back.
That's exactly what it was, although I thought it managed two seasons.
It may have. I didn't really pay enough of attention to it to actually watch it, but as a political nerd, I was aware that it existed. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if it got a good two seasons.
The hook of it, or at least what brought it to my attention, was that it was apparently produced or written by the guy who made Doonesbury.
Oh, that adds an interesting twist to it.
Yeah, for satirical looks at Washington, I thought that was, that had some creative power at its corner. It honestly wasn't that funny, though.
Well, I think that's the element that makes it a golden age, though. It's not that everything that's out there is good. It's not that everything out there is worthy. It's that there are a lot of experiments that are done, and a lot of people that are given a choice, given the ability to try something out. And a lot of it fails. A lot of people aren't nearly as good at making a TV show as they think they are, or aren't nearly as entertaining as they think they are. But then you get surprises, shows that break through and are far better than anyone expected them to be. And having that kind of creativity that can break through, in my mind, is what makes it a golden age.
And with the lower expectations of TV shows to draw those audiences these days, because you're never going to get the numbers that you used to, those shows are more willing to take those creative chances and just aim at serving a particular demographic, and you get these much more unique voices.
Right. You can achieve success at a much smaller number than when you had to be a show on ABC that was one of three channels, and you had to roughly appeal to a third of the American public, it's tough to have something high quality and interesting that appeals to a third of the people anywhere. But if you can appeal to 30,000 people, you can make something that, honestly, a lot of people are going to think is quirky and no good. But if you're one of those 30,000 people, boy, you're living the high life at that point.
That's why there are so many revivals, I'll bet, in part on Netflix and such, because so many of these shows, which couldn't command a large enough audience but were undeniably good and became cult hits back in the day, can survive in this environment. It's been said that Arrested Development would have gone the full seven seasons or however long if it had just been started a little later. I think most brown coats would like to believe the same is true of Firefly.
If only that show had had a chance with somebody other than Fox producing it or airing it.
Twin Peaks got to finish out its storyline recently.
I did see that. That's a show that I have only the vaguest notion of what it's about. I thought it was some kind of soap opera drama, honestly, until I saw who was promoting it. And then I thought, well, I doubt those people would be promoting a soap opera. I admit, I have no idea what Twin Peaks is about. But I do know it's very popular among a certain set, and there are people that are very happy it got to finish.
Yeah, like everything else, we like to think that serialized television just kind of popped up. And in fact, it just sort of rose up steadily. I mean, you've got your daytime soap operas that were always into it, but then you've got X-Files and probably Buffy the Vampire Slayer and all these shows, which just kind of had this continuity they occasionally checked in with, this overarching story just in the background. But Twin Peaks was definitely serial television, and so when it just disappeared after two seasons, I'm sure the hardcore fans were upset, although by then it didn't have many of those. Twin Peaks had this really meteor-like rise to fame. For one season, it was all anyone was talking about. And then, like Heroes, I think, on ABC, all of a sudden, you know, it couldn't get itself arrested.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
and thinking of TV in general, serialization is a good thing to bring up about what makes this a golden age as well. Because all of the shows I remember from growing up were very non-serialized. You could watch pretty much any episode at any point and never feel like you'd missed anything. But that, of course, meant that the characters never really changed or evolved in any way, because nothing that happened in an episode would affect them beyond the boundaries of that episode. And I think it was probably Deep Space Nine that I discovered first, that was a show that actually had a continuity where the characters did change over time and the events had an impact. And then relatively shortly thereafter, discovered Babylon 5, which is even more of a tightly focused, very scripted story. And Buffy, you know, I've been rewatching that with my daughters, and even in season two, Buffy has a fairly tight storyline that goes from episode to episode. There are some episodes that kind of ignore the broader story, but most of them check in on it in some way, shape, or form. And I find that kind of storytelling vastly more entertaining than the non-serialized shows. I like a story that takes a while to play out and really gives the events a chance to breathe and the characters really a chance to react and be affected by things. And we've got so much more serialized television today than we ever have before, that it really is, you're sitting down and you're watching stories when you sit down to watch a TV show. It's not just a 45-minute standalone piece of entertainment.
All true. One little factoid I'll add or ask about, actually, because I was only just informed of this. Are you aware of the Deep Space Nine controversy vis-a-vis Babylon 5?
Oh, if you've watched both shows, the controversy is not something you have to learn about. It smacks you right in the face. The two structurally have a lot of similarities. And my understanding is Babylon 5 was on the air first. So I'm certainly open to the idea that the creators of Deep Space Nine kind of ripped it off. But they did it well. So if they did rip it off, I kind of forgive them for it at the same time.
Well, fair enough. Yeah, and there's nothing new is new for long at any rate. Yeah, there's there's teething pains where all this serialized storytelling is concerned, because of course the typical format for television still kind of has this hold. So even with shows that debut entirely on the internet, we have these 10 and 13 episode formats that Netflix, for example, seem completely unwilling to break from, and that often seems to result in some padded storytelling and just stuff that just isn't kind of finding its natural shape. Just because you can go longer doesn't necessarily mean you want to. But no, I mean, I completely agree. My favorite television ever has all been telenovelas.
Yeah, there's just something about getting to know a character and getting to follow them and getting to see how one thing leads to another. That I think just makes you identify with the character and just be far more interested in the show.
We've briefly discussed favorite television shows real quick. Did you want to note yours or what you're watching these days?
Nothing particularly jumps out. I'm kind of between shows at the moment. Okay, technically I have one episode remaining of the first season of American Gods. I am going to get around to finishing that. I think it's partly, once I watch it, it's over, and it's been such a pleasurable experience that I'm not quite sure I'm ready for it to be over yet. But no, I'm still trying to pick out what my next show is that I'm going to become immersed in. And it's just another scenario where there's so many choices that I'm looking at about 10 different options and trying to figure out, okay, which of these 10 is the one that I want to become close personal friends with for the next couple of weeks?
January and February, thankfully, have not tempted me very much, but a lot of good stuff starts this month or in April.
Yeah, I believe Jessica Jones Season 2 is getting ready to drop on us in the next couple of days.
Yes, that's definitely been on my radar, and not only that, but Better Call Saul Season 4.
Ooh, and I just finished Season 3 a month or so back, so I am very much in the mood to jump into Season 4.
I really got to get on that. I'm actually behind by a full season, as I may have told you.
Yeah, I think you mentioned it, and you definitely want to get on it, I think. Avoid anything about Season 4, because there are probably spoilers. Possibly unavoidable spoilers if you read anything at all about the show. So just don't.
Oh, no. Okay, I'll do my best here. As you know, I've been having trouble getting around to my entertainment lately. I've been on the same book for the last 4 months. It's a big book, but nevertheless, the same book.
Are you still working your way through Oathkeeper?
Oathbringer, and yes, I'm at 82% now, so the end is in sight.
Ah, you're just getting to the good part.
It's all been pretty good so far. Brandon Sanderson's become pretty bankable as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, he's gotten really good at what he does. Although, I've got to say, his books, and this is not meant as a criticism in any way, although I can understand how it come across that way. His books have a definite structure and a definite element of a boss fight near the end of the book. And boy, does he do that so well. He's gotten better at making the rest of the book just as entertaining. But his boss fights, you could translate those to film as visual spectacle so easily. And they're so entertaining. And they really take advantage of where the characters are at. They're not just tacked on for cinematic purposes.
I feel like I've noticed that, and yeah, I'm sure more of his tropes and what's the word I'm looking for? His
tendencies.
Yeah, sure. Let's go with tendencies. His tendencies would leap out at me, or even bother me if I read too much of him. But I'm pretty comfortable with reading the next installment of the Stormlight Archives every couple of years.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you focus on just that one series, you pretty much only have to worry about reading a new one every 3 years or so, although the output of that man is incredible on an annual basis. He does an annual blog post in December every year, somewhere between Christmas and New Year's, generally, the annual State of the Sanderson, in which he talks about each of the series that he's currently writing and what the plans are for the next book in the series. And he just has so many series that he's writing at any one time, all of them well written, moving smoothly from one to the other to the other. That you read his end of year summaries and you look at his output, and then you look over at poor George R. R. Martin or Patrick Rothfuss, who are respectively sitting, I think, at 8 and 5 years since the last book in their series came out. And you just wonder, or you just think to yourself, authors are very unique and special people that cover a wide range of just how they write and what their process is. And it really is miraculous.
Yeah, no two are created the same. This is very true. While we're on books, what are you reading right now?
So I'm again at a point where So I have a certain amount of money to spend on entertainment each month that's mine to control. And lately I've been spending it on other things, so I'm a little bit cash poor. So the books that I would normally be buying and reading from Amazon, I'm not buying and reading from Amazon because I have no money to buy them and read them from Amazon. So I've been browsing the library, just almost getting back to my high school roots, browsing the virtual shelves, seeing what's out there and what looks interesting at any given moment in time, and then checking it out and reading it. And this is an area where, amongst many other reasons, books is a golden age for me because I've got a Kindle and I've got access to the Brooklyn Public Library, which has an ebook collection somewhere north of 200,000 titles, I believe. So there's a lot there to browse. And there's something truly fun about being able to look at a book, say, that looks interesting, and within 2 minutes, have it open and be reading it without having to ever leave the house. That's just, it's so much fun. And for a book geek who had to drive 30, 40 minutes to get to my favorite library growing up, being able to have a collection that's immensely larger and immediately on demand, you just can't beat that.
No, you certainly can't, as bookstores all across the nation have learned. Yeah, that Kindle changed everything, didn't it? I was an early adopter of that. I very rarely am an early adopter of any new technological bauble. I still don't have an Apple Watch and all sorts of things. But I got myself a Kindle, and it was wild. Still is, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard if you're not a reader and you've never tried out a digital reader, it's hard to communicate just how much having on-demand books changes things as far as reading experience goes.
Now, here too, though, the book market is completely fragmented. And some, as someone who writes and, you know, would love to just be able to spend all his time doing that, I wonder if, you know, the age of the novel or the book has not essentially passed as sort of a self-supporting business for authors. Because at this point, if things are just, there's more output today than ever before, like in so many other areas that we've been discussing. But almost none of them can grab the audience that they used to grab. Even John Grisham and these other big names are not pulling the numbers they used to.
It's interesting you wonder whether novels will work as a storytelling medium, given the sheer number of doorstoppers that are published each year, including Mr. Sanderson's works. But I definitely understand where you're coming from in terms of audience. I don't know if I would say that there's less of an ability to earn a living. I think the income at the top is certainly becoming less than it used to be as reading fragments, but I think as number of readers increases, and again, the fact that you can have a global audience today, which was much, much harder to do 20, 30 years ago, I think expands the number of people who are available to read someone at the mid-list or slightly lower down. So I haven't looked at the numbers. Maybe someone who's hugely familiar with the numbers would challenge me on this. But I would tend to think there's maybe a little bit more of an opportunity at the low end than there used to be, and a little bit less of an opportunity at the high end.
Oh, the numbers, let me tell you, are brutal, my friend. I didn't come prepared with them, so I can't offer them to you. But it's a vanishingly small percentage of writers these days who are capable of supporting themselves entirely on their work. It's not just, you know, as we would say, perhaps if we were discussing politics, you know, it's not just the 1%, it's the 1% of the 1%.
Is that, do you think, and I'm purely speculating here, is that because the income has gone down or because the number of writers has gone up so substantially that there's just more and more people fighting to get noticed?
Oh, I think it's definitely the latter, that most writers, or that there's just, sorry, blanked. No, I definitely think that writers are, wow, that's embarrassing. Hold on. Oi.
Writers are struggling to write. Is that what you're trying to say, Adam?
Yeah, sure. This is, you know what? Maybe it's not competition that's the reason I can't write for a living.
it's competence rather than competition.
Maybe as Steve Martin says, some people have a way with the words and some people not have a way.
I do think the sheer number of new writers that's out there, it actually presents one of the challenges. And it's not just in books, but books are where I spend so much of my entertainment time that it's where I notice it the most. There's so many books out there, it's hard to find the ones that I actually consider to be of a sufficient quality and of a sufficient interest to actually want to read. I feel like I'm wading through massive stacks of stuff that, in my opinion, is a useless waste of time looking for the books that are actually entertaining to me. And so I'm excited that so many different people get to try their hand at writing, but at the same time, I wish the ones of them that had less talent would just stay out of the way so I could find everybody else's stuff easier.
Yeah, the needle's all the harder to find in the haystack. Now that's so right. I really think that not only are all these artistic art forms exploding, even though each particular product tends to have fewer or a smaller audience, but that everything is pretty much being done better than it ever has before. And there are these rare exceptions, I'm sure, but, you know, art tends to incorporate all of these concepts from previous iterations. You know, every artist stands on the shoulders of the artist that came before. And so it's only natural that, especially in a day and age when more than ever there can be these people who are fully committed to one thing, that you just see it continuously refined. I think that's my judgment in general on mainstream comic books, you know, stuff by Marvel and DC, your Spider-Man, your Batman, your Superman. It's old timers or people who've been reading these for a while kind of have often turned curmudgeonly because we feel like they're just recycling the old ideas and the like, which of course is true because they're adventure serials. But I do think that they're pretty much being done better than they ever have been. I think, you know, between today's Spider-Man stories and the original ones in the 1980s, the originals you have to credit with actually coming up with the concepts and so forth. But in terms of execution, we are eons ahead.
Yeah, there's definitely a win and a lose side to imitation and to reinvention. You know, it's something I see with books where someone will write a book that's good and is really popular, and seemingly the next week you will find 300 clones on the bookshelves of people who are writing essentially the same story, just change the setting and rename the characters. And at one level, that's depressing because that's just more stuff that you have to wade through to find what's good. But there's also a positive side to it, that you read something, you like it, you want to reproduce it, but you put your own twist on it. And every so often you get something that's not just a dreary clone. It's a clever reinvention of the same idea that takes it off in a different direction that is genuinely interesting and genuinely entertaining. And so you get those jewels that pop up amongst everything else. And I think you're right. I think that's true in comic books as well, that sure, it may be the same story, but it's done with a lot more depth and a lot more nuance and a lot more emotion than it had been before.
And what else are you going to do, really? I mean, obviously there's creating new characters and the rest, but for these characters that have been around for a very long time, the only thing to do is expand or go off in different directions or look at things from another angle. So exploration is the only way forward, really.
And comic books, perhaps more than other mediums, seem to me to harken back to the roots of a storyteller gathered around the fire who's itinerant, moving around from group to group, and telling the same story to each group that he comes across. And then people from those groups grow up and they become, some of them, storytellers and retell the same stories, sometimes exactly the same, sometimes with small changes. And That's really what, what am I thinking of here? oral. That's really what an oral storytelling tradition is all about, is telling the same story over and over and over again. And comic books are really a form of that. I mean, how many stories can you tell of Peter Parker? The art isn't so much in coming up with a completely brand new story, although if you can, bully, congratulations. But if you can't, how well can you take the story that was before and adapt it and change it to the modern time and make it something your own that's still the same thing that it was?
Right, taking these stories and adapting them to a new time and making them continue to speak to us is, that's really the name of the game. I mean, this is something even your pastor does on Sunday mornings, try to get across to the audience the power that these stories had 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, how can you make the old story something new and interesting again? And you're right, adapting it to the time is so important because, you know, Marvel Unlimited is one of the things that I think makes comic books a real golden age for me, is just sheer availability of materials that I can pay on the face of it, a very reasonable annual fee. Let's see, it was $70-ish, which if you divide it by a typical $4 an issue comes out to less than 20 issues worth of cost, and you get 50 or 60 years worth of comics to read through. It's just an incredible deal. But I've been going back and poking through, in some cases, all the way back to the origin of a given character. And while the Peter Parker of 1950 or 1960 is still entertaining, in some ways it's a very alien character because the time that the story takes place in is so different from the time today. And being able to take Peter Parker and retell those same stories today gives them so much more of a dramatic oomph than they would otherwise have if we were just rereading the stuff from the Golden Age of comics.
I find myself engaged in a sort of mental exercise here where I'm imagining how to maximize my limited entertainment budget. You know, if you were on a desert island, what three entertainment services would you subscribe to? And this is not an entirely theoretical idea for me, because I may be closing on a property soon, in which case I will be house poor, as the term goes. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, if I can just have MoviePass, Netflix, and Marvel Unlimited, I guess I'm good.
And maybe maybe a Brooklyn Public Library subscription, although if you're really only reading 4 books a year, that doesn't really pay off for you. But, at $50 for access to their collection, boy, is that a good deal, too. So much stuff to browse through. But, yeah, it's an interesting question. If you could only pick three, which three would you pick to have the most amount of both quality and quantity with the least amount of cost?
We've gone through most forms of entertainment here, but I think we may have saved the most relevant for last. This is not only the golden age of board games and computer games and movies and TV and books and comics, but people are calling it the golden age of radio because of podcasting, and rightfully so.
Rightfully so. It's amazing the takeoff that podcasting has had. Podcasts were a thing when I was in college, but boy, was it clunky, because you would go to a website, you would find the latest MP3 file that had been posted, you would download that to your computer, you would, if you were really a Luddite, you'd burn it to a CD so you could listen to it in your Discman. If you were on the cutting edge, you'd have some kind of really clunky MP3 player that you would manually plug in and you would transfer the MP3 file over. And so quite understandably, podcasts back in that era had a very, very limited audience. But boy, today with smartphones and with always on 4G LTE internet and with great podcasting apps available, the medium has just completely taken off like a rocket.
Well, with people being busier than ever, though, this portability of listening devices and in conjunction with podcasts, you know, I mean, it's no wonder they've blasted off.
Well, and I think a key part of the appeal is the fact that it is available to you on your schedule whenever that happens to be, whether that's one episode a week or whether that's five episodes a day, you get to control it. Because radio was great, but if there was a radio show that was on at 10 and you had something else you had to be doing at 10, oh well, you miss the show. But if there's a podcast, you almost don't care when it gets released because you can listen to it whenever is convenient for you. And I think, you know, in terms of a golden age of radio, I think that makes a huge amount of difference.
Yeah. In fact, if you miss your appointment programming on the radio, often it's released as a podcast. I heard an episode of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me that I missed on NPR recently because it's posted on the podcast channel.
Yeah, and often if there's a radio show I'm interested in, the first place I'm looking for it is my podcast client of choice to go and find it that way, mostly because what with my work schedule and family schedule, there's very few things I can do on any kind of a set schedule. And being able to subscribe to it and grab it, it's sometimes the difference between hearing it and not hearing it at all.
Exactly so.
I think part of what has contributed to the rise of podcasts is also the production end has gotten a lot easier. As I never tire of telling people, I've got a $20 app on my iPad that allows me to take the audio from my microphone and the audio from your microphone and with a very minimal amount of work convert it into an MP3 file that's our conversation sounding really good. Maybe our conversation is completely inane, but the sound quality is incredible. and I think that makes a huge difference when you're talking about podcasting. The fact that almost anyone can set up a couple of microphones and put a show out, and that it's getting easier and easier and easier to create a podcast. Sure, you get a lot of people who really have no business talking publicly, but that's easy to ignore. And as a trade-off, you get a huge amount of voices that otherwise never would have made it onto radio, or in some cases got kicked off of radio, that are able to keep and maintain and gain an audience as a podcast, which is just, again, part of what makes it a golden age is the production side of things and the fact that we get to hear from so many different voices. And part of what I think makes podcasting unique over and above radio is you almost feel as a listener like you're forming a relationship with the hosts. You get to know them. You get to know their quirks. You get to know the way they think about the world. You get to anticipate or wait for their reaction to different things. And it feels like a very personal medium in a lot of way, especially because it can be just regular guys and gals that are putting it together, bringing them into your life for entertainment purposes in a way that's just not possible with other mediums.
I like that thought. Yes, I've, and this is true for multiple forms of entertainment. You know, I followed a blog for at least 10 years, just because, long after I stopped being particularly interested in whatever series of articles I was reading, it was just about this voice. It was about a sort of friendly personality that was a presence in my life. The equivalent for quite some time was your morning talk show host. Everyone driving to work, but getting to hear that same reassuring voice on the air. And there are a number of writers and hosts and the like that that describes for me. One example would be I'm still listening to is the House to Astonish podcast with Paul O'Brien and Al Kennedy. They've been reviewing comics since the Usenet days, and they've just always done it, never struck it really big, and I've always really appreciated Paul O'Brien's analysis first, but when he hooked up with Al Kennedy, I enjoyed Al too. You know, and that's been going on since high school.
Yeah, and I think it's something we've mentioned a couple of times now, but just the idea that entertainment can be customized for who you are. You don't have to be listening to someone who is writing for the broad masses, for the lowest common denominator. You can be listening to someone who kind of shares your outlook on things. And so when they review something favorably, you know you're going to like it. When they pan it, you know you're not going to like it. And it doesn't matter if their audience is 30,000 people instead of 3 million people. They've got 30,000 really devoted fans who like their viewpoint and their opinion. And I think that really matters in terms of entertainment value.
Absolutely. The downside, of course, is that the center cannot hold. But on the whole, I really do enjoy this democratization of entertainment and voices in general. I think in a obviously this plays into identity politics, but just in a very general sense, I think there's been this rapid increase in representation. You can listen to people like you now, no matter who you are. And sometimes that's maybe not a good thing. Maybe you need to listen to a different voice. But on the whole, I'm glad you can.
Yeah, I think there's real value in being able to listen to and enjoy something that's comforting. It's nice every so often to be pulled out of my comfort zone and be challenged, but there's other times where I don't have the mental or emotional energy to be challenged, and it's really comforting to, whether it's a TV show, whether it's a book, whether it's a console game or a podcast, be able to pull up something that's just comfortable and familiar in a way that wouldn't have been possible previously.
Well, I do believe the plan is to do both on this podcast. We're going to dive wholeheartedly into some comforting old standbys, but I think we're also going to be challenging each other by introducing each other to a few experiences we haven't had before. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's definitely right. And that's something I'm looking forward to. It's very easy to get into my groove and to not bust out of it and to look over at a show that other people are enjoying and go, oh, well, that's fine for Adam, but that's not really my style. But I'm looking forward to being challenged and finding out what it is that you think makes a show so great, even if it maybe doesn't push all of my buttons, but learning how to appreciate something and seeing the artistry in it that you see.
Ditto. Well, if I can introduce a little symmetry to this episode or end it on a symmetric note, it's a magical world, Joe, old buddy. Let's go exploring.
Let's. Good night. Okay, normally I'd put in the closer, but the minute passed, so I'll just cut that in post-production.